Welcome back to Political Rewind, everybody. I'm Bill Nygut. I hope you all had a restful and, more importantly, healthy weekend. We're all set with another week of shows for you on GPB Radio. We have a really good mixture of shows, I think, for you this week. Today, we're going to talk a lot about the science of coronavirus and talk about the health factors involved in the virus. We're going to have a political show for you tomorrow in which we'll look at the elections. Later in the week, we are going to have Dr. Ray Kotwicki, who's the chief medical officer at Skyland Trails, a psychiatrist there, to come back and talk with us about mental health issues in terms of the virus. So we've got a lot of content for you that will take us from politics to the coronavirus. And today, I'm really delighted that we have a terrific group who are going to help us understand some of the aspects of the virus that may still be troubling us. Let me start by saying Jim Galloway. He's a lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and he joins me on Mondays and Fridays for the show. You read him on Wednesdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition of the paper. And he oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. And I'll bet he spent the weekend, as you said you were going to do, Jim, doing some woodworking.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to make things in order to make things. This was a make things to make things day weekend.
Okay. Okay. I don't know if I want to go into that, but we'll just take your word for it. We're welcoming back Scott Steiner. He's the president and CEO of Phoebe Putney Medical Center in Albany. And Scott, we're awfully glad to have you back. We've had you on this show in some of the hardest times for Phoebe Putney. And I think today we are going to be talking with you about some of the better news that you have out of Phoebe Putney. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, Bill, that's a fair assessment. Thanks for having us on today. I think we're starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel. We still have challenges, but we'll certainly get into that.
And of course, as the show goes on, we want to hear about some of the challenges and how you dealt with them as perhaps practical steps that can be taken elsewhere in the state. And we're joined by two first-time panelists for Political Rewind. Both of them are medical doctors and professors. Dr. Kamara Jones is an MD and professor of community health and preventive medicine at Morehouse School of Medicine. And I believe you're a visiting professor. Is that the right description of the work you do at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University, Dr. Jones?
So I'm an adjunct professor at Rollins, but actually this year I am a Radcliffe Fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health, so I'm actually trying to make my way back to Atlanta as we speak.
I was going to mention that next. Now I'm feeling intimidated by your presence on the show, but I'll try to get over it. Thank you very much for being here. And also Dr. Harry Hyman, who is a medical doctor and professor of health management and policy at Georgia State University. Harry, I've been reading you in the quoted in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution for some time around the virus, and I'm really glad we're getting to have a chance to talk to you on the show. Thanks for being here.
Hey, I appreciate the opportunity, Bill.
Okay, so I want to start this show by reading you all a passage from The Atlantic, which appeared this weekend. It's an article, the beginning of an article, by Amanda Mull, a staff writer at The Atlantic. And the reason I want to read this is, from my point of view, this sort of sets the tone for everything, all of the topics that I think we're going to talk about today. Here's what Amanda Mull writes. The most universal experience of the coronavirus pandemic in America might not be a sense of fear or anxiety, but a profound confusion over what exactly is going on. Novel pathogens are confounding by definition, and since the first COVID-19 case was confirmed in the United States in January, information about severity, spread, and a seemingly ever-expanding list of symptoms has trickled slowly and inconsistently out of emergency rooms and local health departments. Conditions are improving in some of the country's major cities, she goes on, but outbreaks continue to grow in others, as well as in prisons and rural areas, especially those that are homes to large meatpacking plants. Every state tests at a different rate, makes those tests available to different types of people, and counts the results differently in official statistics. As some states have begun to partially lift shelter-in-place orders and allow businesses such as restaurants and hair salons to reopen, One particularly high-stakes point of confusion has emerged. When can you tell if a state's reopening guidelines are keeping infection numbers down, and how long do you have to wait before you feel sure? I know that was a lot to read, but Jim Galloway, I have to say, as a journalist, that summarizes for me exactly the difficulty that I have found in how we address what's happening here. What about you?
Well, it's kind of, yeah, it's the metaphor that I'm hit with most often is like trying to build a plane while you're flying it. I think Dr. Hyman has something to say about this.
Yeah, I think I was actually quoted as saying it's like trying to fly a plane on a really cloudy day without radar. But I think the most important thing that's missing is leadership. I think at times of a crisis, we rely on our leadership to provide a clear and consistent voice and clear and consistent messaging about what the problem is, about how the problem is being addressed, about what we know, about what we don't know, and about how we're going to get from what we don't know to what we need to know. And I think what we're seeing both nationally and at the state level is a piecemeal approach to managing a pandemic, which is really a recipe for failure. And so I think that's a big part of what's driving the confusion.
And I have to build on that, Dr. Hyman. Another part of the confusion is that from the beginning in this country, we have been treating the coronavirus pandemic not as the public health issue that it is, but rather as a medical care problem. So at the very beginning, our testing was not the kind of population-based, widespread public health surveillance testing you would do, but it was confirming the diagnosis one by one, and people who were sick enough at that time to be in hospitals had to have a doctor's order and the like. And the fact that we haven't been treating this as the public health problem it is, but rather treating it as a medical care problem, has made it a huge medical care problem that was at risk of overwhelming many of our health systems. So how would we treat this differently as a public health problem? Well, first of all, I have to say that our only strategies that work right now are the individual things of shelter in place, social distance, wear a mask, wash your hands and don't touch your face. But what we really need is a different kind of testing as well, so that we can know what is happening in our communities today.
And that kind of
all
leads.
Right, I want to
leads directly into the question of the CDC. I mean, beginning on Friday, you saw that you saw this blistering editorial out of The Lancet, saying complaining that the CDC had been sidelined. You had a White House aide, top White House aide Navarro, criticized the CDC, saying they let the country down on Meet the Press on Sunday. These are the kind of things you don't want to read in the midst of a pandemic, I don't think.
Okay, so let me, if I can, hit the pause button for a second, because you all are you're sketching out themes that I want to address throughout the show today. So if you don't mind, let me back up just a step, because I think we're going to go down a list and take all of these things in a way that we can expand on them more fully. Dr. Jones, I'm especially interested when we get to that point to hear what you mean by we need to do a different kind of testing, and we'll talk about all of that. But let me start. I'm going to get to Scott Steiner in a moment because I want to get your best practices down there. But you, in fact, are going to be impacted by the same thing that the rest of the state is. And, Jim, you can start us off on this. Early voting began in Georgia this morning. We have locations across the state more limited than ever before. Each precinct is supposed to be taking precautions to deal with potential for spreading the virus, hand sanitizer, distance between the voting booths, styluses that people can use instead of touching the screens, all that sort of thing. But Jim Galloway, the fact of the matter is we're going to see people starting to show up and vote at a time when we simply don't know what the dangers are of the virus continuing to spread. And by the way, Scott Steiner, they're going to start voting in Daugherty County too, obviously. But Jim, what are you seeing as early voting gets underway?
Well, number one, you've got about more than 1.4 million requests for mail-in ballots. That's encouraging. We don't know how many of those ballots will be turned in, but I think what we're I'm kind of eyeballing June 9th as the first major group activity that we're going to experience. Because so many people will probably want to cast their ballots in person. Older voters like to do that. African Americans have a history of doing that. So it's going to be a challenge. Workers are going to be handing out styluses. We got new touchscreen voting, which is great. They're great machines, but they're not exactly what you want during a pandemic.
Yeah,
should people be worried about showing up?
Yeah, I would actually correct one of the things you said, Bill, where you kind of suggested that, you know, we don't really know what the impact of this is going to be. I think we do. I think we know that this is not a safe practice. We know that the number one responsibility of government is to ensure the safety and security of the population. Voting by mail is safest. There is no way to vote in person and not increase your risk for contracting coronavirus, and that's true for June, and it will be as if not more true in November. To the extent that we don't have another option for June, rather than reducing number of polling places, we should rapidly ramp up the number of polling places, because the more polling places, the fewer people per polling place, and both the easier for access and the better for safety. We also need to not only provide hand sanitizer, but provide face masks for everyone who shows up without their own to vote in person. So I think we, as a society, and our Secretary of State and leaders in particular, have a responsibility to ensure that if we're requiring people who weren't able to vote by mail this time to do it in person, that we have to ensure that it's done in the safest way possible.
All right, let me get Scott Steiner into the conversation. Scott, you have worked tirelessly along with your medical team, with public officials in Daugherty County, in Albany, to try to tamp down the virus. And now you're going to have polling places open there as well. You're welcome to address that, but in a more general way, help us, as we set up our conversation moving forward here, know how things are going right now in Albany, what you think about people showing up at polling places, and where you expect to be in the weeks ahead.
Thanks, Bill. Well, you know, we are, you know, we're cautiously optimistic about where we're going with the number of positive coronavirus cases here in Southwest Georgia. Today we just got the numbers. We've got 40 positive here in Albany, another 10 in Sumter, in a hospital we operate there. Sumter County to our north. So that's from a high of over 180 just about 5 weeks ago. So we're seeing that's positive. The number of positive tests in the community is coming down. For us, we're really looking at two events. One was Mother's Day, and one is Memorial Day coming up, and seeing what happens 3 to 7 days post that event. For Mother's Day, we have seen a bit of a spike since Friday. Now, it's not huge, but it could be coincidental, but we are seeing that. So, we're paying attention to serving our community and doing that as we've done since the beginning of this. What we have to do going forward, we're getting ready to open a simulation lab, and one of the great pieces with that is you can have simulated coronavirus patients, COVID-19 patients, and how we can use that technology and that not only today, but as we think about a fall spike. So we're already preparing for not even another surge here, but for what comes in the fall. I think as far as polling places go, You know what I tell you, and Dr. Hyman said it, you know, I'm just a believer. Everybody's got to be in a mask. The only reason I'm not in a mask right now is because I'm in my office alone. But everybody's got to be in a mask, washing their hands, socially distancing when possible. And I think if we can do that at polling places, I think we'll be successful. But when I've seen the pictures at a Home Depot or a Lowe's or a Sam's or a Walmart or a Publix, and 20% are in masks, we know this virus spreads in, there's super spreaders, but more it's super spreader events. And what we have to make sure is that polling and that going to vote doesn't become a super spreader event.
Dr. Jones, how do we start? You know, I thought Scott said something very interesting there. He said, well, we saw a little spike after Mother's Day. We're looking for 3 days down the road, a week down the road. This is part of the thing that makes us also puzzled, is now that Governor Kemp has opened up the state, we don't quite know what to make of the numbers and how we might see them progress or continue to fall. I mean, how should we be looking at this, Dr. Jones?
Well, yes. So it's a big problem when you're not doing the kind of testing in a surveillance way where you can know that your estimate can blow up and say, we know that this many people in Albany are infected today. So what we're using is we're testing part of the people who are infected, only the symptomatics for the most part. And we already know that between 25% and 60% of people have been estimated to get this infection, be able to spread it, but never have symptoms. So that's the first problem, is that the CDC criteria still talk about symptomatic. And the only times that we're doing that, we're kind of testing symptomatic and asymptomatic people, is when we go into a nursing home or into a prison, or sometimes when we go into a meatpacking plant. But we need to be, so I'm not saying we have to test everybody in Atlanta, for example, every week, but we can do what's called probability sampling, the same kind of sampling that the health department does all the time with our telephone surveys, the same kind of sampling that the CDC does with our National Health and Nutrition Examination surveys. We know how to do this, so that we can test a sample of people, which would give us an estimate today of how much infection is there. And it would allow us especially to identify asymptomatic people and start isolating them and doing the contact tracing on them that we also need to be doing for the symptomatic. So the big problem is, instead of saying, here we come to Memorial Day, okay, now, and I think it's not even 3 to 7 days, it's really 2 to 14 days. It could take 2 to 14 days for symptoms to show up. So then we're going to wait for 14 days to know that we had a big event that happened 2 weeks before. And now, knowing that this virus, especially without masks, is spreading exponentially, we'll have no idea. It will be late to the game and unable to control. The main problem with our testing is that we're documenting the course of the pandemic, and we're not doing the kind of testing that can allow us to change the course of the pandemic. That's the big problem right there.
But Dr. Hyman, why don't you weigh in on this?
Yeah, I think the other problem is that we're getting a lot of confusing, I'll call it political speak, because this is political rewind, about what the data means. On the one hand, you know, you have the governor saying that, you know, and I'm talking about Georgia, you have Governor Kemp talking about, you know, we're following the data and that's guiding us. And then, stunningly, a week later, you have the commissioner from the Department of Public Health acknowledge that, well, yeah, we kind of opened up the businesses, even though we didn't meet any of the White House gating criteria, the very basic criteria showing downward trends in cases and illness. And then she kind of adds to that, but we're looking at many things, not just the data. And then just this past week, you have the governor talk about, you know, how he's excited about the percent of positive tests going down even as we ramp up testing. Well, that's exactly what anyone would expect, right? You start broadening the number of people you test, not just people who are highly symptomatic, and the percent of positive will go down. So I think, again, it goes back to the earlier point we talked about in regard to clear messaging with the public about what's going on. And that clear messaging is important in terms of the public's understanding of their sense of risk. if they get a sense that, well, everything's going back to normal, they will behave like things are going back to normal. If they get a sense that, yes, we're making progress, but everyone has to be very strict about maintaining the kinds of protection that Scott talked about in terms of distancing and masks, then I think there's a way forward.
Hey, Bill, let me jump in and pitch something at Scott Steiner here. Mr. Steiner, your area of Georgia has been one of the hardest hit in the entire nation, and I think what both Dr. Jones and Dr. Hyman were describing is kind of there's some social fatigue with this how we're having to behave in a pandemic, and I'm just wondering. Number one, how is your community at large dealing with that? And then, very specifically, how is your hospital personnel dealing with this fatigue? Because they've got to be exhausted.
Yeah, Jim. You know, I appreciate that. They, you know, what we've tried to do as we've come on the backside of the sort of, you know, of our peak, is to and really due to the governor's support, and I have to give him credit. He really brought in some resources and assets, and part of it was staffing. You know, for that first 6 or 8 weeks, it was all of our staff, and they were working doubles, and I think we had 54,000 hours of overtime in a 4 week period. And and so, again, thanks to the governor and his team, they did bring in additional resources and people. And that's, I always think, people say, well, do we have enough beds and different, you know, enough space? The space is the easy part. It's those critical care nurses. So because the governor did that, we've been able to give people some rest and some much needed time off. That doesn't mean what they've been through, it's over and it's clear of their heads. You know, we know there's a big mental health piece coming post this event, not only here in Albany, but throughout the world. Some of these clinicians have seen things and had to do things they only had read about and maybe had nightmares about. But the decisions they had to make are gonna be long lasting, and so we're paying attention to that. We've got a group and we're gonna resource that as we think about going into the future, that mental health aspect of our care team. And that's just not nurses. I mean, that's doctors, that's housekeepers, that's respiratory therapists. This has been an event and we're paying close attention to it, and we're trying to give some distraction as well. Last week was hospital week, and while we couldn't celebrate that in the normal ways, we tried to again celebrate that team and have opportunities for them to disconnect even just for a weekend or a few moments. So something, Jim, we're absolutely paying attention to, and those chapters still have to be written.
And how about the community at large? Are they tired of what they're going through? Are they giving up?
Yeah, no, I don't think they're giving up. I tell you, we've got an incredible community here in Albany. Nobody raised their hand and said, "Gee, let it come here first." We were 10 days before New York really busted, and so you know it happened, and we were prepared, I think, as well as we could have been. We've dealt with it. The community has been incredibly supportive. I think in general, do people just want to go shop or they want to just do things? Absolutely, we're seeing that. But you know, I was talking to a group of pastors on Friday, and they were asking our opinion about, gee, you know, what about this and what about that? Is we were also sending them that article out of Washington State about that choir, where most of the choir picked it up from one choir practice, and you know, just from the deep inhaling and breathing, and one person that was infected, and so, you know, they were already on top of it. They said, "Hey, we've suspended choir practice for you know until we can see in the future," and they ran through what they were going to do. I was impressed. I mean, they were going to be vigilant with it, and so we are seeing that. Are people fatigued a little bit? Absolutely, but I don't think there's any despair out there.
So we got to get to a break, but I wanted to just mention that Tom Faust just sent me a note that kind of refers to what you're talking about in your community, Scott. 54,000 hours of overtime for medical personnel. That's a staggering figure. Is that just your team, or is that the statewide number that we're looking at right now?
No, that's just Phoebe Putney.
That's unbelievable, and that also raises a question we'll get to a little later in the show, which is that there are hospitals in the state, and I think Phoebe Putney is not right now one of them, that are not getting the money from the federal government that was committed to helping hospitals pay for many of the costs. You did pretty well on that, I believe, Scott, but I know that there are hospitals around the state that are feeling that they've been neglected, and we'll talk about that a little later in the show. I want to move forward. We're going to take a break now, but I thought Jim Galloway said something interesting that I can't wait to hear our doctors, Jim Galloway and Scott Steiner, talk about, and that is, what does it mean if we're becoming weary of sheltering in place, following all the rules? What does that mean for our future? And I've got a great quote from the Washington Post to read to all of you to talk about when we come back. This is Political Rewind. Welcome back to Political Rewind. I've got a great panel today. Scott Steiner, President and CEO of Phoebe Putney Medical Center down there in Albany. Dr. Kamara Jones, who is a professor of community health and preventive medicine at Morehouse, but right now is doing a what are you doing? Are you doing a residency up there, Dr. Jones? I don't want to say it wrong.
I'm a Radcliffe Fellow at Harvard.
Thank you. Radcliffe Fellow at Harvard. That's fine. Dr. Harry Hyman, who's a doctor and a professor of health management and policy at Georgia State University. And of course, Jim Galloway, who's my partner on every Monday and Friday show. Okay, so Harry Hyman and Kamara Jones, I really want to hear your take on a story that the Washington Post, and everybody else can weigh in as well. The Washington Post published a story this morning. One of their reporters went up to Avalon, which is the big, very high-end development, mixed-use development up in Alpharetta. It's been open since, I think, like 2014. The correspondent was up there over the weekend. And here, again, I'm going to read a little Reader's Theater again. Here's the lead. The sky was blue, the sun was rising, and as the death toll from the coronavirus continued to soar across much of America, the fountain switched on in Avalon, a development of restaurants and shops in a wealthy corner of suburban Atlanta. It was time for life to resume, Georgia's governor had decided. So a masked worker swept the threshold of Chanel. A clerk brushed off windows at Fabrique that had gathered dust. A gardener fluffed pink roses in planters along the sidewalks where signs on doors said what so many had been waiting to hear. Open, read one. Welcome back, said another. In this grand gamble, Georgia has gone first, with Governor Brian Kemp dismissing public health experts who've warned that opening too soon could cause a catastrophic surge of deaths, placing his faith instead in the citizens of Georgia to make up their own minds about risks and sacrifices they were willing to accept. What the reporter goes on to document is people standing together, restaurants being literally crowded without distancing between the tables. People were not wearing masks. Dr. Jones and then Dr. Hyman, what is this behavior going to lead us to?
It's going to lead to much more infection, because this virus only has one job, which is to reproduce itself, to replicate itself. And so even though it hit certain populations earlier and harder, those were the populations that have been, have structural disadvantage baked into our society. So we have, black populations, brown populations, indigenous populations hit harder and first. They're not going to be the only ones hit. And I think that that's part of the confusion, that some people feel, well, that's not for me. They also, people don't understand that in some places, maybe just 0 to 5% of the population has been infected, and we don't even know if they're immune or not. Up to, I would say, maybe 20% in New York City may have been affected and may have antibodies, but we still don't know if they're immune. That means that there are a lot of people who are susceptible to this virus yet, and it's highly infectious. I just want to leave you with an image. I do a lot of communication through images and allegories, and I don't have the perfect one yet, so I'm going to tell you that right now. But in my mind, we do not understand that we are under siege, that we're under siege by what I am thinking of right now as snipers outside. So if you go outside, there are snipers who aren't going to get everybody. It's not somebody with an automatic weapon, but they're snipers. And what you need to do, the safest place is in your home, right? But if you go out, you need to protect yourself with the body armor and all, which is actually the way we're protecting ourselves is protecting each other. My mask protects you. Your mask protects me, but we need to do that kind of thing. And the scariest thing about this is even if you're not hit by this sniper, you might inadvertently let a sniper into your home behind you, and then that sniper has a much higher chance of getting everybody else in your home. So this is, we are not, I'm not trying to instill fear, but it's a fearful thing. This is a deadly disease that is not a respecter of anybody's station or geography or anything. It is making its way through the people. Its only job is to reproduce itself, and we need to take it seriously.
All right, so is there a point... Let me just ask this, and then you can say, you can talk about any part of these you want. Is there a point, though, to the governor's assertion and other public officials' assertions that we have a responsibility in this too? Social distancing, wearing masks. The public has to play a role as well as towing the line in terms of whether elected leaders say a state or a community is open or closed, don't we?
Yeah, you know, so Bill, public health is about creating the conditions for people to be healthy. Part of creating those conditions means not putting people in situations where they need to make choices between what's good for their health and paying their rent, or you know, having to go to work using public transportation, which may put them at risk. So I think part of the challenge here is that it sounds good to say that we're relying on Georgians to make responsible decisions, but if I'm renting an apartment and about a third of the population in our state rents, and my rent is due, and we don't have a moratorium on evictions in our state, and my job opens back up, and I either come to work or lose my job, it's not really a real choice. And then I go to work, and if my employer isn't providing me what I need to be safe in terms of ensuring social distancing, providing me with personal protective equipment. So, again, I think Kamara appropriately made the point, which I hope we can talk to more about, the disproportionate impact this pandemic is having on communities of color and low-income workers, but that lead-in quote you had from the Washington Post, you know, you were talking about the gardeners and the servers and the other people maintaining the grounds. They don't have a true choice in the way that you and I might, sitting in the comfort of our home, working behind a computer, about those kinds of things. And we haven't created the policy safety net around ensuring that people are stable in their homes and have access to food and the other things they need to be healthy to allow them to make those responsible choices.
Yeah, Jim, I want to get you and Scott back in here, but I do want to point out, you know, we have tried to really focus on any number of our shows on the disproportionate impact this virus has had on especially African Americans, and we have to continue that. We cannot let that go because it's an example. It's just one more example of how the virus is exposing in even more dramatic terms the schisms that exist among us in our communities today. And so, yes, I'm glad you brought that up, Dr. Hyman. And Dr. Jones, I'd love to have you get into that. Jim, though, let's continue, and then we can turn back to that. Jim, I don't go out. I'm 73 years old. I have not been to a store in weeks. And I try I'm going a little crazy here. You don't go out much. You're younger than I, but you're still in that risk group. You go to Costco every now and then at seniors' hour, but
yeah,
we're not going anywhere.
No, I will tell you what, I went to, my wife and I made two stops yesterday, one to pick up lunch at a restaurant takeout. And the other, I did have to go into Lowe's to pick up a bit of wood, and I will tell you, each time I was masked and gloved, you know, and disposed of the gloves as soon as I walked out the door, But getting back to what Mr. Hyman's and Dr. Hyman and Dr. Jones were saying, one thing that's really stood out in this in this pandemic is the measurable differences in responses between Democrats and Republicans. You know, Republicans have been far more skeptical of it, and that's why of the need to take precautions, and that's why I think Governor Kemp's decision to don a mask whenever he's out in public, I think that did a tremendous amount of good. Mr. Steiner, I'm wondering has the skepticism barrier been broken down in Daugherty County? Does everybody actually now appreciate much more the is there a commonality of response here?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, it's been an interesting, it's an interesting period. At first, there was the rumor out there that it couldn't affect African Americans, and we had to get out and tell people, and as Dr. Jones has said, this virus doesn't care. This virus has one job, and it's to infect, it's to attack. And so I don't think there's skepticism in our community in Southwest Georgia. I think, again, there's some fatigue with, not being able to do what we're normally able to do. I think there's this sort of, hey, we're Americans, and you can't tell me, you can't tell me to wear a mask. And there's a bit of that out there. But I think for the most part, people understand it. They know it can affect them, and they know people that have been affected. They know people that have passed away. We had a judge here locally who passed away because they got it through a trial. It can affect anyone, any age. We know it certainly can be slanted towards those that are older, those that have comorbidities. But what's interesting is we have more African Americans that have contracted the virus here in Southwest Georgia, but the mortality rate for the white population has been almost 50% higher. Maybe it's a tyranny of smaller numbers, but we won't know until we really get into the data down the road. But, I think our community is doing a good job in taking it seriously as much as I've seen any others.
Dr. Jones, have you seen – there's obviously been a lot of reporting in recent weeks on, the disproportionate impact on African Americans. But given that the story has been out there for a while, are you seeing any reason to believe that it's having an impact on elected officials, on public officials, on health, facilities around the country? Is anybody doing anything?
Well, that's such a great question, Bill, because we can't just notice or document this disproportionate impact. We need to act. And so in order to act, we have to figure out why are we seeing that. And my analysis is that it's a twofold issue, that Black Americans are more exposed and less protected. So those two things together make them more likely to get infected. And then once infected, they're more burdened by chronic disease and have less access to healthcare, which makes them more likely to die or have at least a severe experience of the infection. And so we need to address the causes and solutions for each of those four things. The two things that result in us getting more infected, more exposed, so we already talked a little bit about that, because of occupational segregation, we're more likely to be in frontline jobs, often low paying, without paid sick leave, no accumulated wealth, not able to just say, take this job and shove it, or to, stay at home safely. So we're more exposed in the jobs there, but we're also more exposed because we're overrepresented among homeless populations. We're more exposed because we're overrepresented in the prisons, all of that. So in terms of what do you do policy-wise, well, we need to make it more feasible for more people to safely stay at home. So that means, in addition to the one-time $1,200 per person, we need to consider what's being proposed, I think, at least in the House bill of, a monthly payment to enable families and people to stay at home. We need to decarcerate folks. We need to safely house unhoused people, not in shelters all crowded together. So there are many things like that. In terms of being less protected, which is also contributing to having higher infection rates, for those who who we need to be, you know, they're the public transport drivers, the custodians and sanitation people in the hospitals, the postal workers. I don't know that we need meatpacking people there because we can all eat vegetarian, but anyway. But the people, that, you know, the sanitation, all of these people who are essential, they need to have the protective equipment that they need. They need to have hazard pay. They need to have paid sick leave and all of those protections. So that's how we do on that one side. In terms of once we're infected, we're more likely to have chronic diseases. Well, that is because of decades, generations of disinvestment in communities and racial residential segregation, which turns into segregation in terms of exposure to environmental hazards and segregation in terms of the availability of healthy food or even green space and the like. So we do, in the long term, have to invest in our communities to turn those situations around. But in the short term, we have to recognize if these populations are being more highly impacted, we need to have more testing available in those populations. Maybe, and certainly still not restricted to people who are symptomatic. So maybe you do community testing, one block by one block, testing everybody so you kind of have a sense of what's going on. We need to enable people who are positive to have a safe way to isolate, not sending them back into housing that might be multi-generational or lots of people crowded in. So we need to do, you know, what they did in Singapore and other countries and have isolation centers that are even for low level, you know, people who aren't drastically ill, but who are infected, where nurses could monitor temperatures and oxygen saturation levels twice a day. So anyway, right.
I've got to get
on and on.
I thank you for telling us all of that. I do, though, have to get to a break right now. When we come back, we've got time to talk about a couple other issues related to the coronavirus here in Georgia and, for that matter, in the United States. You're listening to Political Rewind. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Quick note before we move on. I spent a good amount of time this weekend reading and responding to as many of your emails as I could. I continue to really want to hear from you. It's so gratifying to me to hear how you're experiencing the coronavirus, how it's impacting your lives. I do try to respond to each of you. But I have to say, in general, the thing that really is really rewarding about them is most of you say that the experience, you're having problems, there are difficulties, we're all experiencing that, but how many of you feel like you're doing okay? And that's heartening. And so continue to write me. I'm at bnigut, B-N-I-G-U-T, at gpb.org. Dr. Hyman, I know you wanted to respond to what you heard from Dr. Jones, and let me add a layer to whatever you wanted to say. You started out in this program talking about a lack of leadership. I assume that you see that across the board from federal, from the White House down. Jim Galloway has already alluded to the fact that Peter Navarro over the weekend, one of the president's closest advisors, was dismissive of CDC's work. At this point, we focus on Georgian numbers all the time. The United States has like 4.5% of the world's population, and we are rapidly approaching having a third of the COVID-19 cases in the world. And I assume that speaks directly to the kind of leadership we're getting. But go ahead, Dr. Hyman.
Yeah, well, I would say two things about that, and we touched on it earlier. Look, we have a premier federal public health agency right here in Atlanta that deploys all over the world to address epidemics and serious disease outbreaks. And for reasons that I can't fully explain, but I could certainly make some educated guesses, they've been told to stand down. And I think one of the most stunning examples of that was when they came out with 17 pages of guidance and guidelines for how businesses can safely open up. And it was essentially shelved by the White House and replaced by about 6 pages of infographics. I think in the absence of clear evidence-based federal leadership and coordination across the country, this continued piecemeal approach to managing a pandemic is going to lead to the numbers that we're seeing. I think on the state level, we have similar problems when we have a commissioner of public health who says, you know, that it's not just the data that's guiding their decisions, You know, what we're seeing is this false choice between addressing the public health crisis and addressing the economic crisis. And I think certainly all public health experts, and I would say most economists, recognize that we can't reasonably address the economic crisis and open up the economy unless we control the public health crisis to the point that we can do that in a safe way. If I can just add one quick local layer to the numbers from Dr. Jones, I'm also struck that when the governor and commissioner of public health talk about vulnerable populations in our state, they don't reference the fact that African Americans make up about 30% of the population of our state, but to date make up 49% of the COVID-related deaths and about a similar percentage of the cases. But I have to do a little bit of statistical manipulation to get at that number, because we still have, quote, missing and unknown race and ethnicity status for about 25% of the cases, which candidly is unacceptable. So I think, to Dr. Jones' point, knowing that, inaction in the face of that harm is unacceptable. That requires us to be very mindful of what we're opening up and how we're doing it in a way that ensures the health and safety of those populations at greatest risk.
You know, Scott, mentioning that we don't have data on so many victims of this disease does say something about the preparedness of the state to deal with something, a pandemic of this sort. You would think that would be one of the first things that you would want to find, is who's getting the disease, their ages, their race and ethnicity, and yet there's no consistency across the state. And I suspect that's because, and you would know this down in your area, Scott, we're governed by a group, by county health, public health facilities across the state rather than an overarching state public health agency. I mean, we have that, but each county determines its own destiny, right?
That's right. They have regions. I think our public health director here serves, I think it's in excess of 15 counties, the public health department. So there can be quite a bit of just geography in what the public health department is trying to cover. And we've known, you know, from the beginning, not the very beginning, but I'd say our 4 or 5 days in, we realized, wow, we better get our act together around the data, because one, we knew we wanted to be transparent, and I think we have been, because if we're not transparent, then, you know, then it's sort of chaos ensues. People will fill in the blanks with whatever they want to fill the blanks in with, and I think the state has realized that, may, albeit a little bit late. But it's a mystery to me why there's still this great percentage of unknown races. I could tell you every race of every patient that we've had tested here, and I would venture that every hospital in the state of Georgia also has that. So we've got to true that up, because, you know, boy, if we don't learn from this, we will certainly repeat it.
I'm glad. Go ahead, Jim.
No, I was, and this, I hope I'm not veering too far off course here, but Mr. Steiner, where the state right now is facing a kind of a $4 billion loss in state revenue. Have you been brought into any conversation about how public health spending ought to be handled in this area, in this era? Money is disappearing, and the need is ever greater.
That's right. You know, we've certainly, from the state standpoint, we've heard Speaker Ralston and the appropriations chairs, both at the Senate and the House, talk. I've been on Zoom conferences with them. You know, there's not a lot of details coming out about how the state's going to get their budget balanced and what the budget's going to look like. You know, from the healthcare standpoint, there's a tremendous amount of need, and we know everybody's hurting. Everybody's hurting in the community, not just just hospitals, not just, you know, small businesses, everybody is. So, you know, there's been a lot of discussions, not a lot of details. They're going to get back to going here in a few weeks, and it should be an interesting, it's going to be a sprint to get to that July 1st date, and a lot of eyes are going to be open because it's going to be painful. There's going to have to be some give and take. So, you know, Jim, we're waiting and see what's going to happen.
Dr. Jones, we're rapidly running out of time, but as I just mentioned, the emails I'm getting are mostly positive takes on how people are getting along. I want to end on a positive note on this show. Morehouse School of Medicine just graduated a class of doctors over the weekend who are preparing to get out there and work to fight the virus. First of all, congratulations. I know you're up at Harvard right now, but it must be thrilling to you that your current class is going to be able to join this fight.
Yes, the Morehouse School of Medicine prides itself, first of all, on leading the creation and advancement of health equity. That is our mission, and our students, we are committed to going to where the need is. And so I think that you're going to find that our students throughout Georgia and actually throughout the nation, but a lot of our students stay in Georgia and work, will be amazing. So, yes.
Well, congratulations on that. All right, we are basically just about out of time for today's show. Jim Galloway, thank you. Dr. Harry Hyman, Dr. Jones, thank you. Scott Steiner, always a pleasure to have you with us on Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We're back with another show tomorrow. Until then, take care and please stay healthy. See you tomorrow.